you know, I wasn't in the party. I mean, I wouldn't take.
Most of the partying started after.
Sure.
No, after the whole thing was over. After most people had gone home. Ask Scott about it sometime.
Well, I was at all of them until I quit, and there was partying going on every evening after the meeting was over. I mean, you know, people getting loaded and fucking around and shit.
Not like that one. That was insane. It was a nice
kind of
insanity.
Well, I don't know, but I'm not
arguing
the point of whether St. Louis had better parties than any of the others.
Well, I think it's just because we hadn't...
It used to piss me off when people would do that.
Well, it was, you know, we were still high on DC-3, and the world was ours, and the war was going to end, and, you know, it was a whole other time. And then by the time Kansas City came around, so much had changed.
Yeah. I was in Killeen, Texas, which is where I met John Niffen for a Christmas action, and I went from there up to Chicago, so I did two different actions, because I did some speaking up in Chicago. And, not much came down. I guess the three most significant things were Dewey Canyon 3, the Republican convention and the trial. Everything in between that, I mean, you know, local actions and all that, we were always doing something in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. And a lot of my time was spent on the road because I was speaking. And I went everywhere to do that. I was speaking. And the National was asking me to do things. I went to Toronto for them for an Amnesty conference. Did that thing in Europe.
When did you go to Toronto?
May of 73, for the first Canadian Amnesty Conference that I know of. It was pretty fucked up. It was just a big political play so Amex could get all the power to speak for the exile community. And all we did was use our clout to get them that power, which was unfortunate. Because Amex was, you know, another yada 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 Marxist bullshit anti-imperialist organization. Amex did a lot of good shit. If they did nothing else but put out that magazine, they did good shit. But I went along with it all because they were the most viable organization.
Okay, I'm
going to
change the subject then. Now, my recollection may be way off, but I'll tell you what my recollection is, and then I've still got some. And then you set me straight. I think you called while I was in Gainesville in December, right before Christmas, 72, talking about having been approached by the FBI.
Paul Scotty that day.
Tell me about that.
The FBI had been nosing around for a while, and they called me at my home one morning and asked me if I would be willing to submit to an interview. And I said, well, sure. And so they said, well, we'll be at your house in 30 minutes. I said, well, okay. So I'll be here. And I was later criticized real strongly by the National Office for allowing the FBI to interview me. My feelings at the time, and they still are today, were that I wasn't going to have any problems. I had enough confidence in myself to know that they weren't going to get anything out of me except things that I was willing to give them. They came up, and plus, as a regional coordinator, I knew they were nosing around the region, and I felt like I had a responsibility to my membership to know what the fuck they wanted to know, so I could warn my people and give them the option not to talk to them. But if they did talk to them, at least to know what kind of shit they were to be asked. I didn't feel like I could tell anybody, no, don't talk to them. What I did tell them is you don't have to. You never have to. Even if they subpoena you, you don't fucking have to talk to them. You know, you can go to jail. But you don't have to do squat. So they came up And they were really heavy. They were really, and they knew their shit. They knew their shit. They didn't know the fucking VVAW or the Gainesville 8 from a goddamn pork sausage. I had a friend of mine who was about 5'5", weighs in about 150, 160 pounds, real muscular, blonde beard, blonde, almost white hair, come out and take the license number off their car when I went out to talk to him, and they said, "Is that Scott Camille?" And I said, "Are you kidding me?" They said, now come on, tell us the truth. We're going to find out. Is that Scott Camille? And I said, "No, man, that ain't Scott Camille." And I said, "Well, and then 30 minutes later, they said, "Are you sure that's not Scott Camille?" Because he came out to check on me. And I said, "No, it ain't fucking Scott Camille." I said, "But I got to admit, he looks a little like him."
He's got a beard.
Yeah. I just thought, fuck him. They came up and they told me that they weren't talking to me about the Gainesville 8. "We don't want to talk to you about that." They says, "What we want to know is, did you receive a phone call from Scott Camille on such and such a date?" The fact of the matter is that I probably did. And it had to do with, I assume these tapes are going to be erased.
If you want.
So, they asked me if I'd received a call on this date, and I said, "Jesus Christ, I don't even know if I was in town." I said, "Now, you guys know that I do a lot of travel. I'm on the road all the time. Because I tried, at least in the state of Kansas and Missouri, I'd go to every chapter's meeting if I could." Mm. And that meant driving all over the goddamn state of Kansas and Missouri. I even went to South Dakota to meetings. In fact, I established a chapter in South Dakota, in Sioux Falls. And, so I was doing a lot of traveling, and I was speaking all over the fucking place, organizing demonstrations and giving speeches and shit. So I told him, I says, "Now, you guys, you're at almost everything I do, or you have someone there." I says, "You know where I am and when I'm where." I says, "I don't know, because I don't keep a schedule." And he said, "Well, did you receive a call?" I said, "God damn." I said, "You know," and I tried to let, I came across as really wanting to help him. I was just really eager to be of help. I says, "Damn." I said, "Why do you want to know?" And they says, "Well, we think that Mr. Camille's been making phone calls on an illegal credit card. And there's a grand jury that's going to be seated investigating him for interstate violation of some code on making phone calls on an illegal credit card across state lines or some shit. I can't remember. But I knew it was bogus. They want to know about that phone call to see if it tied in with the Gainesville 8 conspiracy." And I said, "Well, you say he called me?" And I said, "Yes." And I said, "Do you know if the call was collect?" And they said, "We don't think so. We think he made it on a credit card." And I said, "Well, goddamn, there's nothing I can do to help you." I said, "As you know, I'm resisting the federal phone tax, the excise tax." And I always preface things by, "as you know." And I said, "And so I keep all of my phone records because they bear directly on my tax resistance." And they said, "Yes, we know." And I said, "Well, if I had made the call to Scott, or if Scott had called me collect, I could go in and get my phone records and we could settle it right now." I said, "But unfortunately, if he made the call, there's no way for me to tell." I said, "Did you monitor the call? Then you'd know." And they said, "Well, no, we didn't. We just have reliable information." Well, that's bullshit. They had a tap on his phone, for sure. They possibly had a tap on mine, and it turns out that they probably did. So they had two fucking taps, but both of them were illegal. And that's why they couldn't use them.
Why do you say it turned out they probably did have one on yours?
Because they knew too much. They knew too much about other things. They knew things about Wounded Knee and about Cable. And so I assume that they knew. Plus, one night, I had a house full of people, and I was on the telephone talking long distance, and I got feedback through my telephone that was so loud it could be heard in the next room.
Oh, that can do a number of the year.
It just about blew my fucking head off.
I bet.
And people came in saying, "What the fuck is that?" And I'm holding my phone thing, and it's going, "Ree, ree, ree." You know, and it was just pretty fucking weird. And so I talked to them.
What are you talking about when you get the feedback? I can't even remember.
You know, I mean, I took this whole thing pretty lackadaisical. Because I knew I wasn't violating any federal laws. when I went to Cairo, I knew that they could get me on the H-Rap Brown Act if they wanted to. When I went to Wounded Knee, I knew they could get me on it if they wanted to. But I knew they'd have to stretch it. Because I wasn't breaking any laws knowing. And my FBI file, which I finally got, later bore me out. After I got the file, I wanted to take it and shove it up the ass everybody in national office that had criticized me. Because it talks about that interview, and at the end of it, it says, it is deemed, they came to the conclusion that any more interviews with me would be counterproductive. And I felt like I had done all right. Before the interview was over, I asked them to donate to the Defense Fund. I asked them to donate to the region. I talked to them about the bombing of North Vietnam. I talked to them about what it was like to be a disabled veteran in this country. I talked to them about what it was like to go to VA hospitals in this country. Because once you start talking, they're going to let you talk to see if they can get anything out of it. And so I knew that, and I just decided that, well, every time they stopped to take a breath, and I mean they took short breaths after a while because they didn't want me to start another fucking little rampage, another speech, and I just fucking wrapped my ass off. My partner had come out to take their license number for
you
me.
You mean Scott Camille?
Right. The blonde, short, stocky Scott Camille.
We stretch him out a little and dye his hair.
Right. Well, he said he almost came out because he thought I would. He says, man, it looked like you were tearing those guys a new asshole. I said, what do you mean? Because I didn't realize I'd been so adamant. He said, every time we looked out the window, all we could see was you shaking your finger at those motherfuckers, man. And I guess I was just told, do you know what it's like to be a disabled vet? And they, when I asked him to give to the Defense Fund, this one agent goes, oh gosh, it's Christmas because this was December. And he said, I've got to buy things for the family. And I said, you know, I'd like to buy some presents for my family, but I'm a fucking disabled veteran. And you know what I get for being a disabled vet? And I went into this rap about what my benefits were. And I says, how much do you think I can get from my family? I said, how much do you make? Oh, gosh. And I said, well, I make $200 a month. And I told him the length of my injuries. And I said, you guys already know that. And then... Oh, it pissed me off. But I guess that's what I must have been shaking my finger in. And I called Scott immediately to let him know the ploy they were using up here. And then at the steering committee meeting in Chicago in January, which was about 2 or 3 weeks later, I guess, I wrote out a full report for them so they could put it in their files. Special Agent Wick and Special Agent Sapp. Sapp and Wick. Those were the two guys that came up to talk to me that day. They suggested to me that since I wasn't willing to talk to them, since I didn't seem to have a good memory, I said, well, was I in town then? I said, how should we know? And I said, mm-hmm. I said, well, I don't remember. I said, so if you guys could tell me, it would help me nail this thing down. I said, I'm a busy man, you know. And then I told them that, they told me that I'm not to be surprised if I was going to get a subpoena to a grand jury in Tallahassee, Florida because of my bad memory. That they thought that, you know, that I would, that the grand jury might not be willing to accept the things I'd said. You know, I knew what the implied threat was.
Which was?
The implied threat was that I would go down to, I would be subpoenaed to Tallahassee, Florida, and if I didn't talk, I would go to jail for contempt of court. That they would, we have ways of making you talk, sort of rap, you know, the old Gestapo or Vopo border guard rap. You know.
Vopo?
Yes, East German police for the Russians. The Vopos were the big bad guys in the early 60s because of the Berlin Wall. Everything you heard about was the Vopos because the Vopos, Volkssturm police, people's police, would shoot the people as they tried to run across the barbed wire.
Just the kind of police the people need.
Fucking A.R.A.
That's what we're going to get here soon.
Mm-hmm. So that's what happened with that meeting with the FBI. It was after the January. Evidently, the Gainesville 8 weren't too worried about my response to the FBI because then they asked me to come down the next month to their...
Then I must have been there when you called.
Yeah.
I couldn't...
It was just before Christmas.
Yeah, right. John and I, this cameraman and I, left Christmas Eve, and we were there for several days before that. And the only reaction I picked up in the house
I was there fucking with another buddy, brother or whatever. And they didn't seem to be any worry about you except for you.
That's good. I appreciate their confidence.
At least that's what I picked up on. I mean, we were all concerned that, you know, every time they focused in on somebody, we worried, of course.
One of the reasons that I think there were so many Marines in VBAW and paratroopers is because you're talking about volunteers. And those of us that volunteered were the ones that probably felt like we were screwed more than anybody else because we believed them. They didn't have to come and get us. They didn't have to send us a letter requesting our presence. We went down and asked them if we could go along. So we were more disillusioned, perhaps, and more embittered because we felt like we'd really been lied to and misused the most. I have no statistical information that can confirm that or any surveys, but that's just the impression that I got.
Yeah, well, I figured your guess was probably better than mine.
The Arlington Cemetery?
I don't know if I can fit it in, but it's a beautiful story if I can.
The second day of Dewey Canyon 3, after they'd refused us entrance in Arlington Cemetery on the first day, we received permission to go back in. And we went back. I can't remember how many people. All I remember is that it stretched for blocks and blocks. And we walked into the cemetery, and off to our right, down in the valley, they were burying a kid who'd been killed in Vietnam. It was a military funeral, flag draped casket, firing squad. And while we were marching silently amidst those thousands upon thousands of graves, we heard them play Taps, which runs my blood cold. And then the volleys, they fired rifle salutes over the grave. And you could look down there and see the family, and hear the gunfire in a war cemetery, and hear them playing Taps. And off to our left on a little knoll was the Washington DC tactical unit, whatever the fuck they call their riot police, standing there with their flak jackets and helmets and riot batons and pistols and gas. I really hated them for being there. They were obscene. I don't know what they thought we were going to do. It was our people. But I couldn't take it. I collapsed. Just started crying and couldn't stop. It was the first time I cried in a long time. And I was helped out. There was no trouble there at the cemetery, but the cops were really scared. They were really nervous. Faced by a whole bunch of... when we were quiet, they were more afraid of us than when we were young. Because they just had to assume what we were thinking. And they naturally assumed the worst. They were scared. Paul Francis Withers was my roommate. And my partner. I hesitate to say brother anymore because it's been so overworked. I mean, everybody was everybody's brother, yada yada yada, and all. It seems like everybody that pushed the brother rap was that really pushed it hard were real assholes. A few exceptions, but so I was fairly uncomfortable with that term. But I made a call, somebody, a buddy or a partner, covers it. Paul lived with me just before he disappeared. In fact, he disappeared after, when he left my house. His leg wounds that he received in February of 1968 were still bleeding from osteomyelitis. He was wearing a brace that would clear up to his, to the top of his thigh near his hip. It's the only way he could hold his leg together. He couldn't walk without it. He was on crutches. He went on a number of speaking gigs with me. He went to school with me every day, to the college. He was just the kind of guy that everybody liked, because he was real easygoing. But he was also hard as nails. When he had to be. He went to Cairo with us. When the Klan, or whoever the hell they were, came and tore up my house, he faced them down beside me. And, so can you think of any specifics? I know I'm bouncing about.
I don't think I really know enough about Paul to, you know, especially, I never saw him after that fast.
Hmm. He was one of the most decorated GIs of the Vietnam War. Spent 3 years with Special Forces in Vietnam, doing some on loan to the CIA for two of them, which is one of the reasons why he was so, why so many people were so concerned about anything he might have to say.
Barbara, you know, she was in Boston, so she got to know the Cambridge vets, and therefore Paul, because he did spend some time back there,
mm-hmm.
said that she thought he might have started writing a book about, she wasn't sure, but he was certainly starting to talk about what he had done.
He wasn't writing a book to my knowledge, but that doesn't mean it wasn't being done. He wasn't doing it when he was living with me.
Which is right before.
Yeah.
Any idea why he would disappear, or why?
I don't know. He'd given testimony before a Senate subcommittee that was secret on the CIA and drug trafficking.
When?
That was right after Dewey Canyon, right around the time of the fast. And he used to be a little uncomfortable knowing that they might not. And then they would know exactly how much he was willing to say. And he wasn't sure what their response was going to be. He left my house to go check on his wife and daughter.
Why?
Because she had called him and said that the TAC squad, or Red Squad, or whatever they call them in Boston, had been making threats and giving her trouble. So he was going to go up and make sure that she was all right, and maybe find her another place.
What kind of threats?
I don't know, because I never talked to her about it.
Mm.
But evidently, the story that he told me before he left was that they'd busted into the house.
Oh,
and, you know, ransacked the place and told her that they were going to get Paul and that she'd better be careful because they were going to get her. And they were separated and preparing for divorce. They still bothered him because they knew it was a way to get to Paul. So he'll have to go get him. He never came back. And to the best of my knowledge, nobody knows what happened to him.
Did you say that he didn't even make it?
He didn't make it to Boston.
So it was somewhere in the...
And he was traveling by bus. At least he left Kansas by bus. He hitchhiked all over, too, so... Fights with the Zips. We had a small section. We were protecting 7 days, I guess, before the demonstration started. I can't remember exactly. A lot of this stuff just started running together after a while.
Oh, sure.
But we took the ground and we marked it off and we told everybody this is for the VBAW. There were about 14 of us there. That redheaded medic that And later everybody decided it was a undercover pig. His name had a red Fu Manchu Scott something.
From Alaska?
I don't know where he was from.
Big tall guy?
No.
No. Okay, somebody else.
Short.
Oh, yeah, I know. He was involved with the Selma.
Yeah, farm in America.
Right. Yeah, okay, I know who you're talking about.
Okay, well, he was down there. He was doing good work. In fact, I think he broke his hand firing up a zip.
Firing at a zip?
Firing up a zip, punching it.
Oh, that's a new term.
Well, firing somebody up and lighting them up, same thing. Light up his face, pow, pow. But Tom Fassad had threatened one of our nurses, I think that was Helen from Tallahassee. But I'm not sure. I didn't really know her then. So I'm not sure if that's who it was or not. But Fassad had threatened her with a pistol because she worked with the vets. And we went over and told Fassad that unless he wanted to digest the motherfucker, you know, he better never threaten one of our people again. He got a whole bunch of his little kids, his little jerk-off, cotton-brained people over there smoking dope and all this. He got them to come, let's go get the vets. They're, you know, they're all pigs. They're all FBI. And so they came over with Fassad in the background, urging them on, and to take our campsite. And there was a shitload of them. A hell of a lot more of them than there was us. And we just lit them up. Started punching out the first ones that came in. And the rest of them said, oh, no hassle, man. You know, they didn't want any problems. They tried that a couple of times. I can't remember the red-headed guy's name, but he hit this one dude. Cracked him so hard that his hand was real swollen the next day. And we thought he might have fractured it. But it was just prior to the demonstration, prior to the convoys arriving, it was really a madhouse down there. And then we ended up changing the campground at the last minute when y'all started pulling in. Because the campground that we had, the plot of ground we'd been defending, was much too small for the number of vets that showed up.
Far out.
Yeah. So we had to move on over to where we had this whole field for BBAW. And I can't remember what the directions were. But... And as the convoys were pulling in, and the Nazis came in.
Yeah.
And their national Führer was with them, Kaler or Kaylee or something like that. It was about 15 or 20 of them. And they went up and there was this girl on the stage talking over at Expo 73, was it called? 72. Expo 72. That was the, you know, the exhibit area.
Yeah.
The meeting place. And they just went up on stage and threw her off the stage. But they wanted her bullhorn and she took it with her. And
good
they couldn't get it away from her. So then they took the stage and all we could, you know, everybody was calling, whenever the shit hit the fan, get the vets, get the vets, you know.
That was my greeting to Flamingo Park.
Dig that. So we went running over there. We formed a human chain and forced the crowd back. And while we're holding the crowd back, the crowd's pelting us with full beer cans and rocks. Some people were throwing steel tent pegs. And there were people out there with axes and handles and all kinds of different clubs and chains because they wanted to kill those fucking Nazis. And the Nazis were up there sticking a thumb in their belt and going Sieg Heil and Heil Hitler and all that. Gary Steiger and I was up the stage talking to him, trying to tell him that we couldn't hold the crowd any longer. You know, and we held him for about 30 minutes, as I recall. And they've been trying to get them out. We were trying to negotiate, which is stupid. We were trying to negotiating with a Nazi is like negotiating with a communist. You know? You don't get any fucking where. All they do is take everything. Well, this Nazi, they decided that all they wanted was, number one, no communist flags were to be flown. That meant the communist flags were being flown was North Vietnam, PRG, Pathet Lao, and Cambodia, the Kampuchea. And they wanted only National Socialist White People's Party flags, which is the Nazi flag with the swastika. They wanted only National Socialist White People's Party slogans, and they wanted a microphone for 30 minutes. And I just looked at the guy and I said, you're out of your fucking mind. And then I think it was Gary that said to him, look, you got 3 fucking minutes. and then we'll walk you out and protect you, or we'll carry your ass out and throw you in the street. And I just turned away from the son of a bitch because I really, every time he said something, I just wanted to pop him. It was just really a disgusting little pecker.
Who are you talking to? Did they
this was Kaler. This was the head nigger, you know, of the Nazis. He'd love that characterization. So I walked away from him, walked towards the end of the stage, and this one great big guy looked down at me and says, "Hey, buddy." And that took me off guard, and I looked up and I said, "What do you want?" And he said, "Listen, we ain't got nothing against you vets." I said, "I'm a vet myself." I said, "What are you doing up there?" And he says, "Can you get us out of here?" I said, "I guarantee it. We'll get you out of here and we'll protect you. We're the ones taking the heat right now." I said, "We'll get you out." I says, "All you gotta do is tell that little son of a bitch down there that you guys want to go." And he said, "Okay." And I was amazed. You know, here's another fucking vet. He's with the Nazis. You know, I mean, God Almighty. But he, you know, he was communicating to me as a human being, not as a Nazi. Steve Facade, not Facade. Got a facade on the brain now. Steve Dupree. Blonde-headed kid, wire-rimmed glasses from Dade County.
I don't know the Florida people.
Okay, I think his name is Dupree, I'm not sure. Walked up on the stage and took this Nazi by the arm and said, "Let's go, buddy."
The big one you were talking about, the vet?
No, he went up to another guy. He just, the time was up, and he just went on the stage and said, "Let's go." And this great big fat son of a bitch, if I remember right, maybe it was just because from where I was standing, he looked like King Kong, but he was easily over 6 foot tall and weighed many pounds. Picked up a metal folding chair and hit Steve in the face. That's when the fight started. We held everybody back and held on to everything until he hit, well, that one Nazi hit, I think his name was Steve Dupree, but I'm not sure. Scott would know.
Mm-hmm.
From my vantage point, this is the way it went.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it. Scotty and Carl Brown and a whole bunch of the other guys jumped up on that stage and Scott cleaned house. I mean, Scott was just right in the middle of the stage, just knocking the shit out of Nazis left and right. I was still down on the ground, and the crowd started to break through, and I pushed him back with this other guy, and we linked, had our arms linked, but I had my back to everybody because I was watching the fight. Mm-hmm. I was getting hit in the back of the head by these people, and women and everybody pounding on me, trying to get through. And they knocked this one Nazi down in front of us, and me and this other guy just, you know, I'd tried to bend into nonviolence for quite a while, but when this Nazi hit the ground in front of me, we just started kicking the shit out of him. You know, it was just, he epitomized everything we hated, you know. And we just stomped the fuck out of him. And when every Nazi was down, the fight stopped. And all this time, the VVAW still had that ring protecting them. And then we grabbed Nazis, and just it was just a running wedge. We fought our way through the crowd and out to the street, threw them into the street. And the police were waiting out there. See, we had requested that the police come in when the Nazis came. In fact, I was the one that requested. And they said, "We can." And I said, "What the fuck are you talking about?" And they said, "Hey, you want to police your own area, don't you?" And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "If we come in to bust these motherfuckers, we'll come in to bust you for dope tonight."
Ooh.
And I said, "Ay. And I says, "Now, our agreement was that you would take care of your own problems. And when you couldn't take care of them anymore, then we'd take care of them. But that opens the ballgame. And that's a whole new ballgame." And I said, "Okay, we'll take care of it." I mean, it was because there was a lot of shit that they could have busted people for. And the Miami Beach Police Department did an outstanding job. Well, I don't recall having any problems personally. I never had any problems. My relations with them were always real good. Scotty could tell you a lot more about that. The next day, the Nazis were going to come back. We heard that there, a story that I heard, and this is just a story that I was told by a police officer, was that they jumped in a bus. We passed their bus on the way down. They had a, when I was myself and a newsman from the Louisville Courier Journal, which is, I understand, one of the biggest newspapers in the country. We were traveling down there, Lynn Witt and I, Mike Roach, and Mike Burns, who was the reporter, and a disabled Vietnam veteran, had been a dust off addict.
Hmm.
And we passed this bus with white power written on it, and there were a whole lot of badass dudes standing outside being harassed by the, I guess it was Georgia State Police. I'm not sure if it was Georgia. We were either in Georgia or in Florida by then. But, let's see, what was I going to say? Oh, they claimed that, this police officer told me that a whole busload of them were coming back to get the vets when they stopped at Alums. naturally, and get German beer. And while they were there, this is on the Miami side, before they got over to the Miami Beach side. This one of them went out to hand out leaflets. You know, about the nigger kike conspiracy. That's their big thing, the nigger kike conspiracy. And while he was passing them out, this one young man came up and said, took one and was looking at it, and then the Nazi noticed he had a Star of David around his neck. So the Nazi grabbed it away from him and said, you know, like, I don't know what he did, but they say he grabbed it away from him and called him a, you know, a dirty kike and all that. And the Jew fired him up, just punched his lights out right there on the spot. And when he punched him out, the rest of the Nazis came running out of lungs. And he said that old Jewish people came up and just beat the shit out of the Nazis.
So
he said that we had to pour those fuckers on the bus. Said they were beating them with canes and crutches and anything they could get their hands on. He says, but those old folks made you guys look like Girl Scouts. I said, well, we were practicing a little restraint. And he said, well, they weren't. So that was, I thought that was pretty interesting.
How did you and Gary get picked to...
It was by default. I don't know whose default. But it was the fact that we were there. I saw Gary up there frantic, you know, how Gary gets. And I went up there to talk to him with him. And it just turned out that everybody was talking to him. Mm-hmm. But we were talking to Kayla, whatever the fuck his name was. Because we figured that's the man that's going to give the word. But, you know, a lot of people were talking to him weren't talking to him like we were. They weren't trying to negotiate shit. They were saying, come on down, you scumbag son of a bitch, you know. Jim Duffy, who had the National Committee to Support the National Liberation Front or whatever the fuck it was. I always had a little trouble with Duffy.
I didn't in the beginning, you know, because...
Yeah. He had this steel tent peg, and he was shaking it at him. No, he had an axe. He had an axe. And he was saying, I'm going to protect my exhibit. And I said, that's fine, but protect it behind the line. I don't want you standing out here in front with a goddamn axe. And I was pushing him, you know, because I was getting really pissed off at this motherfucker. He was pretty pissed off at me. But he was standing out there, you know, just really intimidating with his fucking hand axe. I just kept pushing him. I said, get on the other side of the fucking line. And he finally went to the set line. I said, if shit starts, you're going to have plenty to swing at.
But preferably not with an axe.
Yeah. We didn't know what those fuckers had. But,
And you said one of them was beat up pretty badly?
Mm-hmm. Busted his ass. Good. Busted his nose. Pounded his face in. We took him over to a medical van, and our medics treated him. God, I'm sure that guy named Scott. Scott was one that treated him.
Yeah.
And then we formed a protective group and walked him. I can't remember how far it was, 10 or 12 blocks. It seemed like it's a long fucking hunt. With newsmen, we escorted this guy to his car and with the newsmen to take him to the hospital for x-rays and all that. And that's how we did it. I mean, we took care of the son of a bitch. We made sure he got there alive. We could have just kicked him into the street and said, sink or swim, motherfucker. Which is what they'd have done to us if they'd have let us live. But we were trying to be nice. And when we put him in the car, I told him, I said, look, partner. I said, we've done right by you. Tell your buddies not to come back. I said, because it'll just be bigger.
I know that the fact of the 6 indictments affected people.
Made us exceptionally cautious. The word, you know, the thing that we told our regions, and the thing that I was telling people constantly when they start to get out of line, I'd say, look, there are 6 men whose lives are on the line right now that are facing over 20 years in prison. I said, now, if you fuck up, they may have to go. I said, if you want to play around, fuck around, they may have to go to prison for it, because they're watching us now. Anything we do here is going to be used in evidence for us or against us. And that was, as far as I can recall, was the theme of everything we did. VVAW is on trial. 6 men are on trial for sure.
Okay, take either the Nazis or the Zips. To me, they're pretty much the same thing.
The Nazis had some sort of something to follow. The Zips didn't have shit. I mean, compare the Nazis to the Zips, and the Nazis were... somewhat sophisticated.
Oh, yeah. Right. I mean, there are differences, but... I mean, they're not identical by any means, but... Mm-hmm. in my anyway. Do you think they would have been handled much differently had there not been indictments?
No. Because in both situations, with the Nazis, it just happened so fast. Everything came down within about 45 minutes from the time they arrived to the time that we poured them in the street. And I just don't think we had much time mm-hmm. to consider it. And plus, they made it a physical battle mm-hmm. when they hit our one member. And then we just went ahead and cleaned it up. That was just a natural reaction. Everybody pulled up short. I mean, nobody just continued stomping on somebody. Once the guy was down and it was obvious he wasn't getting up, then nobody went ahead and tried to cave in his windpipe or crush his face, or kick him in the nuts or anything. And I don't know, you know, that every individual would have to answer the question why they pulled up short. With the Zips, we were under the distinct impression that Facade was a pig, and I believe that. I'd be willing to go to court on that. He was a scumbag son of a bitch, and I think he was a pig. He was carrying a gun. He got arrested carrying that gun. They let him go. He didn't have to do any time. He instigated more violations of the law than anyone else did down there. But maybe if there hadn't been an indictment, maybe we would have went over there and just fixed his wagon personally. Because there was talk about, let's just go deal with Facade. Let's not deal with his flunky-ass punks. Mm-hmm. These stupid little kids, you know, couldn't even spell their name if they were under any pressure. And there were, you know, this Scott wasn't involved in any of this. Scott was a hell of a disciplining factor, you know, because every once in a while we get some outlandish suggestions roll around, especially when there were so few of us there. Scott saying, "No, God damn it, come on," you know, and he would clear things up for us. Nancy was with him. There was a guy that we had guys coming over that offering to make us bombs. Come on, let's really trash the pigs. I worked this one guy, Scotty and I talked to. I worked for the IRA, and I've been blowing up people for years. And he was wearing a gypsy costume. You know, this motherfucker was just really out there, but he was talking about all the different kinds of explosives, and he says, "And I've got weapons, and we can really kill them." And he talked to me, and I went over and got Scott, and I said, "Hey, I got somebody over here I think you might want to talk to." So Scotty came over, and Scotty and I sat down and talked to this guy, and he says, "Yeah, I'd love to help you kill pigs and all this." You know? And then we finally just told him, we took his picture, and we said, "This guy's, come on over here." Sat him down in this tent, took his picture, asked him a lot of questions. We interrogated everybody. I mean, if there was any question about somebody being a pig, he got his ass into a tent, sat him down, took his fucking picture, and asked a whole lot of questions. And then told them not to come back. We'd take them outside the grounds and say, "Don't let us catch you back here."
There was one story, boy, I can't remember where I heard it, about some guy that was suspected and confronted and then came back with the cops later. Do you know anything about that?
Mm-hmm. Okay. No, I don't. What did he come back with the cops to do?
I don't remember any of the details now.
Well, Harrison and Crenshaw are perfect examples. I mean, finally somebody got to realize that these guys are not on the level, and they came back with the cops. Of course, they were unique because they were active duty cops. You know, they weren't just scumbag informers. They lied like mm-hmm. scumbag informers when they got on the stand. They didn't show an ounce of professionalism.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were stupid. I mean, by the time they got done, I think it was the end of Harrison Crenshaw's testimony when Larry got up and he said, because they said we have rocket launchers and mortars and all this shit. I mean, they just started expanding. Everybody had to expand on the indictment, trying to make it sound more threatening when they realized where they weren't getting anywhere. And I think Larry stood up and said, in fact, one of them said we had rancid pig's blood. Bottles of rancid pig's blood we were going to throw on the, couldn't decide whether, God, it's hard for me to remember, couldn't decide, I think, one of them said we were going to throw it on them before they died, you know, to make them sick and then wipe them out with our wrist rockets. Or after we'd knocked them down and wiped them out with our wrist rockets, then we were going to throw it on them as a symbolic gesture. I mean, who the fuck knows? I don't know where we're going to carry all this shit. Wrist rockets, crossbows, fried marbles, bottles of rancid pig's blood, mortars, anti-tank guns.
Oh, you mean you all weren't going to castrate yourselves carrying those wrist rockets in your garage?
And that's just crazy. John really got him when he said, would you care to demonstrate to me how you would wear one? Yeah, the fucking jury broke out. But I think Larry stood up after Harrison Crenshaw testified, and he says, well, it's rather obvious to me that the only thing that these gentlemen didn't have were B-52s and nuclear submarines.
And all they could produce in court was a cart and a...
That's right, a wrist rockets. Were there 12 in there or something? Okay.
There were a lot of meetings down in Miami Beach, and I was still under the intimidation of, you know, vets business for vets, and others stay out, so I didn't...
Yeah, that wasn't a bad idea.
And so I stayed out of most of the meetings, but boy, those meetings went on and on and on and on.
For sure. Everything we did, once people were down there, we planned out, those of us that had been down there had been planning a number of different types of actions, but none of them were worth shit, because of the way we had this organization structured, because everything had to be voted on by regional coordinators. And so we get all the regional coordinators together and all their advisors or whatever. And before we did anything, we'd have these meetings where we would argue out all the ramifications of what we were going to do. First and foremost, thought VVAW is on trial. Anything we do, we have to do with that in mind. Some people didn't want us to consider that.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of argument about that. Second was, will we have only vet parades, vet demonstrations? The women were really hard in our shit because they were pissed off because we wouldn't let them in our marches. And yet when the women had a march, they wouldn't let us in. And we were supposed to understand. Well, that's because we've been oppressed. What the fuck, sister? You know? You think the vet hasn't? And so we had that kind of problem all the time. I mean, any minority group, or any group, not necessarily a minority group, but any group there that wanted something to bitch about would bitch about vets' elitism.
Mm-hmm.
The people that we had, that we worked the best with, it's not going to sound like it after what I just said, but the people we worked the best with were the women's group, the women's caucus, whatever the fuck they call themselves, and the gays. Because they were the most responsible. And we had that one problem with the women on the marches. The gays never gave us any problem. They were just, you know, they were really into what they were doing. But a whole lot of people lambasted us for our elitism. And yet when we do a march, it'd just fucking knock them down.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, that one march we did down to talk to the National Guard, I had a good rap in the National Guardsmen. In fact, that article, what they wrote about Lynn Witt, and I quoted some of the stuff that we talked about.
Could you get me a copy of that?
I'm sure I've got a copy. I'll try to find it.
I'd appreciate that.
Okay. And I've got the article on the Nazis and the whole works. So.
Anything that you think might at least, you know, fill in my knowledge, whether it actually goes in the book, the more knowledge I have to work from, the more documentation, more accurate what does go in the beard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I'll find that. What do you mean by central debate of regions? Is that, you mean at the...
That's essentially what I was asking about just now.
It's like the guys from New York and guys from some of the California, the Barry Romo type California chapters. Northern California, I guess.
As opposed to Bill Hager.
As opposed to Bill and Fredo and most of the L.A. vets, they didn't go for like political mumbo-jumbo. Was the impression I got, which is why I always liked Bill and Fredo. They were just a lot more human about it. There were some people from certain regions that wanted to throw, you know, this is the place where we confront the pig, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't want to consider anything, because remember that there was only one person that they could even partially relate to in the Gainesville Six at that time, and that was Pete Mahoney.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't necessarily like Pete, because Pete had been hanging out too much with the crackers, with the Southern factions. Even though he was the national office representative, he'd still been, you know, they thought he thought a little bit too much like the Southern factions.
I think I'm familiar with the reaction.
Yeah, it's too fucking bad. But I was second nature charges against me?
Yeah, after, you know, during the trial when you spoke out.
The judge, Winston Arno, Bo Arno, issued a federal court order. It was a gag rule, saying that nobody could speak out on the case. I've been doing speaking tour, doing some radio and TV, and speaking at churches and shit for a long time before the court order was issued. And then I went ahead and I just kept doing it. We had a lawyer. Lawyer advised us that the judge naturally could do any fucking thing he wanted on a federal court order because it was his court order. He's the one that writes it. He's the one that decides if you violate it, and he's the one that hears your reason for violating it and you don't get a jury. And he's the one that passes the sentence. So it's his ball game, his baseball bat, his ball, his bases, the whole works.
Sounds like kangaroo.
Yeah, yeah. So, we were careful on our wording. We decided the press house, I'd been asked to come down long before the trial started. I can't remember when I went down. I'd been asked to come down and work with him because the national office wanted somebody that the Gainesville 8 trusted, and in particular Scott and John, because national office couldn't seem to mold them in any way. And Scott and John and I were very close friends, and the national office trusted me as well. Brian, in particular, representing the national office, he and I got along very well. And so I was sort of a, at least my impression was that I was sort of a buffer between the two. The national office, I thought, did really well during the trial. Brian, in particular, realize that these guys were on trial and we don't fuck with their defense. Mm-hmm. So we chose two people. The press house group got together. You might have been there the night we did that. And we decided it's obvious because the judge came out and said, look, I'm serious about this gag rule. I'll send anybody to jail for violence. National office, all of us got together and decided we would choose two people to speak for the organization during the demonstrations and the trial. And then we would choose people to follow mm-hmm. after we got put in jail because it was obvious to us that we were going to go to jail.
Yeah. And yeah, Bill was one of the followers.
He was my replacement.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact. Which was a good feeling to have Bill behind me because I knew he wouldn't back down and I never trust. Well, you won't want to use this, but I never trusted Bart.
Yeah. I won't. If I say anything on Bart, it's going to be without his name.
Okay. So they chose myself and then Bart. Thought he ought to be in it because he was from national office. So they said, okay, we'll have Bart do it too. And we held a press conference explaining to people about the demonstrations. And I said, you were there that morning, weren't you? First press conference we held in the press house?
I tended to stay away from press things because I was still in that ambiguous, am I a witness, am I a defense worker, just what am I? And I was trying to keep it as simple as possible so that I didn't get hauled in on something.
Yeah. My feeling was until they told me something, fuck them. You know, until they told me I was a witness, I was going in that courtroom every day, you know, and I was going to go out and do shit and all that. So we held the, but that's just where I was at, because, mm-hmm. you know, I felt my position also demanded that I not, you know, I
well,
also
all I saw that I could do would be, you know, if I got into trouble, I'd just be fucking up and fucking everybody up, and so I just couldn't see any reason for it. I had a job to do on Lemur and Becker, and that was first and foremost.
Sure. We had the we did the press conference and the lawyers kept asking us, don't you think this is violating the court order? And we said, no, sir, we sure don't. We have a lawyer present with us right now. This is why do you have your lawyer present if you don't think you're violating the court order? And I said, well, it's just to help us and to advise us so that we won't violate the court order. We have no intention of challenging the court. I said, we want to work with the court system. You know, I mean, we made a hell of a public relations spiel. Well, the that went out into the, it was on television, it was filmed, it was on almost every station of Florida, because we watched it on a number of different channels at night. Well, that night when the Gainesville Sun comes out in the afternoon, came out with a different person, as you well know, writes headlines mm-hmm. than the person that writes the article.
Nice.
The headlines stated that the vets were not challenging, some real negative thing, something about, you know, like disregarding the court's order or making, you know, fools out of the court or something, but it was really derogatory. And then you read the article and it didn't say anything like that.
Yeah, some reporters were really supportive.
Yeah, except then, because they almost put me in prison.
Oh, really?
You fucking ain't right. That judge, all he looked at was the headline. The headline and the article were two different fucking
things. That's what I'm saying. The reporters themselves were supportive. Yeah. The headline was written, as you said, by someone else.
It just pissed me off because, bam, he says, I want those motherfuckers in my office. Called my lawyer. The lawyer said, okay. He took us up there and we sat down. And he asked us if we understood that we had violated his court order. And we said, no, sir, we don't understand that. And we explained to him the thing. We asked him to read the article. He wouldn't buy in any of that. He said, Bart asked him, what about the First Amendment? Bart has this surly way of asking things when he does know. And he says, well, don't you worry about the Constitution. He says, I understand it. I know about it. I'll take care of that up here. And asked if there was anything else we wanted to say. And I just said, sir, we believe that we haven't violated your court order. We have no intention of doing so unless you put us in the position where we absolutely have to in order to protect our freedom of speech and freedom of association. And I said, we believe that the First Amendment is bigger than you are, and it's bigger than this courtroom. And then we left. And he said, well, don't, you know, he says, you open your mouth one more time, words to these effects, says you're going to jail. So we said, we had no intention of doing that, and walked out. Then they caught the FBI in the office, in the broom closet the night before the trial was going to start. And then we knew we had to do something, and we had to go ahead and balls the wall. And I wrote that press release. In fact, they were out waiting because I hadn't finished it yet. I just scribbled it out real quick and went out and read it. And then I was very moved because they all, Gloria Emerson told me that was one of the best things she'd ever heard, you know. And I was just stunned. And they went out and everybody wanted copies. I said, well, God, I just wrote it. And they said, well, could you get us copies in the next 20, 30 minutes? And I said, Jesus, I don't know. And Brian Adams says, yeah, we'll get them to you, no sweat. And they ran off and typed up my thing and then made copies out of it. But then I violated the court order because I accused the judge of working with the government and told him that, you know, that it was obvious from his actions of the night before and of the weeks leading up to this point that he was a pawn of the Justice Department. I just ripped him a new asshole. And talked about why I thought they wanted to destroy the VBAW and why they wanted to destroy these eight individuals. And then I had to go into hiding. Whenever we were out at the campsite, if anybody, like if the cops came out by the campsite, they'd always tell me, Musgrave goes scooting out into the woods, and Camille, that's how I met Camille, really. She hid me. She let me stay at her place, and we moved around. When I had to move, she went with me.
Well, she was a fine woman.
Yeah. And the judge told my lawyer that I was in violation of the federal court order and that he was going to get me. The FBI had come around asking questions of newsmen. The judge pulled in a newsman from the Miami, whatever that big newspaper is now, the Herald.
Herald, yeah.
Pulled him in and wanted him to testify against me. And the newsman said, you want any testimony? He says, turn on your television. Because I was on all three major networks that night, CBS, NBC, and ABC. And it wasn't, you know, they didn't do the whole thing, but they just did a little clip out of what I was saying and explained what I was doing. And the judge says, I want you to testify on the stand. And he said, I'm not going to do it. And the judge told me he was going to go to jail. And the next morning,